Segundo here, and I'm feeling neither strong nor fatherly as I ponder the illegitimate child who sealed my fate and secured my doom. For some, like Heather Armstrong, parenthood gives a new life and a wonderful career, an ability to mature as a person and grow less solipsistic. I can't say that my own life is particularly wonderful, nor wonderfully particular. But Bat Jr. does send me a bottle of tequila every Father's Day, and I still respect the conditions of the court-induced restraining order.
All right, so I'm here with Heather Armstrong, who is most recently the author of It Sucked, and Then I Cried. Heather, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, thank you.
I must ask if you are doing the Kurt Vonnegut timequake thing, because I understand that you are pregnant now. And I did an interview when you had your first daughter, and so I'm wondering if this is a sort of sense of cyclical thing or marketing kind of approach. Or
I absolutely plan this.
Oh, really?
Oh,
really?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. The release date was timed right around this thing?
Right around. You can time these things, absolutely. No, this is, I actually sort of reluctantly was like, oh God, here we go. I'm going to actually go on this book tour 6 months pregnant. And so far, I haven't gone to labor.
Well, let's go ahead and start with some general questions, then I'll get into some strange territory. You're fairly candid about your constipation in this book. On your blog, you've been fairly candid about the answering machine message that your mother left you in which she called you a shithead. I'm curious, given this candor, what personal limits you set on your writing. Is there a peer review process whereby you actually ask every single person who you write about, hey, can I include you in this funny piece? I may go ahead and say something perhaps, you know, slightly deprecatory about you. What's the deal? Well, I know this is a general question, but I'm going somewhere with this.
Well, you know, I think that's the general perception is that I don't have any boundaries, which is fine. I'll let people operate under that perception of me. But, I mean, I'm very careful about what I write about the people in my life. I want them to be excited to see themselves in my stories and not call me up and go, that was horrifying. You know, I don't want that in my life, and I want people to be excited to see themselves. There have been a few times when I've written a couple things about my husband when he will sort of grip the side of the desk as he reads it and he'll go, I'll get over it. But I generally write things so that when people see it, they're going to be happy about it. So I don't really ever check with anyone.
Oh, there is no fact-checking.
There is no checking, no.
Really, really. Is there any kind of filter, really, to what you do? I mean,
yeah, I'm kind of an open book as a person.
Yeah.
So this is just a general extension of my personality. There's a lot about my daughter as she gets older that I'm finding I'm not writing about. And, you know, some vagaries of my relationship with my husband that no one wants to hear about that I'm not going to write about.
No one wants to hear about? Well, or you don't want to share them? Just to draw the distinction
it's
here.
It's not fair to him, you know, to air certain things. You know, it's just not fair. And it's not the right place to air it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because you have letters within this book. And typically you look at a letter, and we're talking letters to your daughter. Typically one looks at a letter and it's a very private action. And yet it is juxtaposed in specific ways that relate your thoughts. I'm curious why put these letters, even if they are perhaps to some degree a fabricated letter, as opposed to keeping these things private, or as opposed to putting them into your first person account, like say, for example, Lita T.
Why
not put it in the first person voice as opposed to the letter form, and why violate this kind of private notion between you and your daughter?
Because it is directly to her. I mean, I write them specifically with her in mind. I mean, nothing is fabricated. Those letters are very real. She's lived all the content that's in there. And the reason I'm doing it is to give to her one day and say, here's your childhood and here's what I was feeling and here's what I was going through. Publishing them gives me the impetus to do it. It gives me the motivation to do it. And I don't know if I didn't have the audience, because many people have written me and said, you know, I wish I had done that. I just can't find the time to sit around and do it. Well, it's my job now and I have people counting on me to do this every month, and it's great motivation to sit down and do it to her. Knowing other people will read it.
This is interesting because it's your job, and yet this is something that a lot of people have fun with. And here, how do you draw the distinction between work and fun in personal writing?
As a job, it's lost a lot of fun over the past few years, and there's a lot of administrative work that goes into maintaining a website and There's a lot of negativity that comes with it as well. But
what kind of negativity?
Oh, there's a lot of criticism, and there's a lot of hate mail and public scrutiny and public criticism on other websites that I have to deal with. It's kind of an annoyance, a kind of an occupational hazard that I have to deal with. And it can get laborious, you know. You wake up and you're constantly hearing someone chatter in your ear that you're an awful person and that you should die, and you're like, oh, maybe I should die.
Yeah, but you've been doing this for some time, Heather. I'm curious why you haven't kind of filtered this thing out. I mean, after a while.
Because I'm a writer, because I'm a creative person, and I really do feel if I ever got to the point where I was an absolute shield and it just bounced off me like steel, that I would lose. You know, there's a sensitivity to me that I think is important in my writing, and if I ever lost that, I don't know if I would be the same writer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense, but I'm wondering if it's really a sensitivity or it's a concern for what your audience thinks about you. That's a difference.
Well, concern for what my audience is very important to me. I factor them into every decision that I've made about my website because they were so supportive with what I went through, and I really credit them for talking me into taking care of myself during postpartum. Mm-hmm. And you know, they factor into every decision that I make concerning like advertising and design and all of that, and I have a relationship with them, and of course what they think about me is important because of the relationship I have with them.
But isn't it a bit odd that you have this happily receptive audience in which you can immediately test your material? Simultaneously, it is a bit odd that they're in some sense almost a focus group to some degree.
Yeah, it is. It is a bit weird. You know, and I have to say that most, you know, 98% of the feedback is really good.
Yeah.
It's just that the 2% that isn't is really loud and passionate and hateful.
Yeah. So. Well, speaking of hateful, rather loud, actually, I must note your fondness for capitalizing specific words and terms. Like in this book, some of the phrases you capitalize include, I smelled like a gerbil, we are going to see a movie, America, amputate her hand, waiting to be bought and used to clean windshields. There are, however, a few exceptions. I noticed that the phrase on the passenger side of the window was merely italicized as opposed to capitalized. On the other hand, you have, oh my God, which is both capitalized and italicized. So I'm curious how this specific emphatic house style emerged and why caps, all caps along these lines, seems to be better for you
than italics. Or is it a matter of you being lazy and
no,
it's
caps
control I?
Actually, a lot of people who I have met, a lot of my friends online, and we've known each other for many years, and they met me after having read my website for a couple of years, and they without fail, they were like, oh, now I see why you do it. It's how you speak. Like, it's how I speak. It's how the words in my head form. Like, it's when something is capitalized, it's capitalized in my head just for the emphasis. And the italics isn't enough, right? It has to be capitalized. But there's something southern and redneck about it that kind of mirrors my personality.
Is it almost like the strange prohibition of exclamation points? Because I think that's ridiculous myself, that you can't go ahead and type in all caps anymore because it's considered shouting. In fact,
right.
The internet has actually discouraged both exclamation marks and all caps.
So exactly.
We have a common problem here with punctuation and style.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, I wanted to ask about your affinity for chilies, which you bring up. I don't think it can entirely be predicated on a love for the chips and salsa or the fact that the server brings two Diet Cokes at the same time. This can't merely be the exclusive reason. So I'm curious if you could elaborate on this particular concern and love and joy you have for Chili's.
I actually worked at Chili's for 3 days back when I was a freshman in college, and I lasted 3 days. I couldn't wait tables. I am not a table waiter. And there's just something about the Americanness of the experience and having that much food brought to you that it makes me feel very connected to the flyover states that normally I'm not very connected to politically. You know, I don't see eye to eye with them, except when they're bringing me those two Diet Cokes and when they're refilling the basket and basket and basket of chips.
Yeah.
I feel very American.
I'm wondering if it's the specific glasses that they use, the specific way in which they bring the Diet Cokes to your table.
Yeah.
Because this is a chain restaurant.
Yes.
There are plenty of restaurants that will bring you two Diet Cokes.
Well, consistently, though. I mean, I've never had to ask for the second Diet Coke. They always bring it. I don't know if it's... And I wasn't taught this rule when I worked there. I just think that there's something about the culture there that they know. They know you need it.
I guess maybe there's subdivisions of Chili's in which they bring you that Diet Coke so immediately. Or maybe it's a Utah scenario.
No, it happened in Tennessee, too.
It happened in Tennessee,
too. It did.
This is an investigative journalistic report.
It really is.
Really, you should pursue this further. I wanted to talk about when Lita is taken in for an MRI and is given some Nembutal. You write that she was as drunk as a 16-year-old on prom night who has had Long Island iced tea on an empty stomach and is in total denial about how drunk she is. Now, this was very interesting to me because I must observe that 16 is right between your age and Lita's age.
I must also point out that this is not
imagining Lita at 16, it's comparing her to a 16-year-old. Does the notion of thinking of Lita at 16 mortify you, and is this why you need this comparative point to someone who is 16 who couldn't possibly be Lita, or what?
I'm probably comparing her to the 16-year-old that I wasn't, actually, and the possibility that she will be very different than I was. I'm raising her ideologically very different than I was raised. I don't want it to seem that it would be okay with me if my 16-year-old got drunk, but there's a part of me that probably needed to when I was 16.
Yeah.
And the thought of her in her teens actually does absolutely terrify me. Yes, it does.
How far in the future can you think about Lita?
Not very far, because no, you can't do that with her. I mean, it's a new lesson. You wake up and you think you've got it mastered, and then she just will knock you on your ass immediately the next day.
There's a constant storm in the present that is endlessly shifting then.
Yes.
Bob Costas, you single him out, going back to the hate question, I did promise.
I've softened on him.
Okay, because I must point out, you declare his voiceover insipid, but here was a man who actually went after President Bush on the Olympics, unlike any other regular journalist. And Bob Costas has a really decent interviewing background, and I'm wondering if it was not necessarily the insipid voiceover of Bob Costas, but maybe the insipid voiceover of the Olympics coverage that was possibly torturing you while you were there.
Probably. I think it was just it was something to focus on in the hospital. It was like, because his voice would drone on, and it's like certain foods now make me sick because it reminds me of the nausea of being first trimester pregnant. And now his voice reminds me of being surrounded by very, very crazy people.
Wow.
And the smell of plastic and urine. That's what his voice now signals to me.
But television isn't a smelling medium, right?
It is, but it's a sound. I mean, it's like music. I mean, it's like music will take you back to your childhood immediately. It's like his voice takes me right back into being, and being like accosted by this guy who told me his life story like 30 times.
Yeah. How about synesthesia? Is that a concern for you? Do you see words in colors or anything? Or?
No.
You seem to have an acute sense of smell from what I've been able to determine from both the book, your blog, and your tweets. In fact, you're the first person I've actually brought up your Twitter feed.
Feed.
Wow, this is a historical moment in the show. I also wanted to ask you likewise about just a general concern about parent writing. A lot of parents who go into parent writing have to deal with the special and unique nature of their children. And I'm wondering if your willful plunge into the considerable exigencies of pregnancy and being in labor and all that was a way for you to, I suppose, justify delving into the special nature, the teeth that we talked about, or maybe even the letters was a way, likewise, to contain that separate from the narrative so that you wouldn't necessarily be, a finger wouldn't necessarily be wagged at you for that particular charge that is often leveled, I think, unfairly, but at...
What charge is that?
The charge that, all these parent writers, these mom writers, these dad writers, they constantly drone on and on about how special their kid is, as opposed to the aspect of parenting. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we do that because my readers have responded to it because we all do think that, and seeing someone else think that justifies ourselves thinking that. We're seeing other people are like, they're thinking the same thing and they're going through the same thing, and I've never thought that I or my daughter are any different than any other child or mother that has existed on this earth. And the only reason that I've written it is really just to reach out in this darkness and isolation of staying at home with an infant and saying, please, someone shake my hand and tell me that I'm not alone. Yeah. I mean, that's the reason I did it.
But I'm also wondering if it's also this notion of pursuing... I have two questions colliding in my brain at the same time, so I think I'm going to go with the second one. I must point out, going back to the Bob Costas observation, I should also note that Janet Jackson's nipple was essentially this kind of central image during that entire sequence. And I'm wondering about this tendency to fixate upon an image and repeat it over the course of
writing. Well, during labor, that's what they teach you to do. Yes. Concentrate on one thing and focus the pain there. And that image was repeated over and over and over again on the television screen next to me. So there's a reason for that. I'm not fixated on her nipples normally.
Yeah, but I mean, fixating upon specific things in your writing, is this a way to, I guess, keep a narrative like this book going?
I think so. I think that's how I tell stories. Even just in conversationally, I'll fixate on something for sure.
I also have to bring up the two-book deal that you had initially signed, which was with Kensington. I know that this was signed basically with a verbal agreement in place. It then went to court, there was a lawsuit, and now the second book comes out through Simon & Schuster. I'm curious why you settled on a verbal agreement, knowing perhaps that they might screw you over in terms of nailing down the written agreement and having something like that.
I wasn't involved in the verbal agreement.
Oh, really? Okay, so this was an agent thing?
Yeah.
Ah, okay, and you got caught in the crossfire.
Yep.
Are you still with that agent?
Yes, I am, actually.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, got
it. This happening has really never happened, I'm told, in publishing before. Yeah. And we were assured by probably a half dozen publishing lawyers that it wouldn't happen, and it did.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of an anomaly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like the Kim Basinger boxing Helena thing. you stated in a 2005 interview with Rebecca Blood that having a baby is pretty much a book of commentary waiting to be written. I am rarely left thinking, what the hell am I going to say today? Now, prolific as the daily events of your daily life are, and as you have intimated to me in this conversation, I must point out that there must be a filtering process of some sort. It's one thing to go ahead and do a blog post. It's another thing to go ahead and have a book. You could have had a 900-page volume here. So how did you filter this considerable array of observations and events in your life into something that encapsulated the narrative?
Well, I approach it, what makes a good story? Yeah. You know, we sit down with my girlfriends on a Friday night and over wine and bitch about what our husbands did or what our kids did, and I'm not going to talk about, you know, the millions of details and minutiae that occupy a typical day. And it's all about what I think my girlfriends, or my brother, actually. I picture my writing as me talking to my brother and getting him to laugh.
Yeah.
That's how I picture my audience.
Okay.
So
one last question, because I know you're about to do a reading, hence the strange sound in the back. I want to follow up with something the Pioneer Press recently asked you. They essentially asked you about the $40,000 a month figure that your website brings in. You responded that you were just a normal housewife, really living in Salt Lake City. However, I should point out the median income in Salt Lake City of a household is $36,994. Now, I don't want to press you on the figure. I don't think that that's fair, and I don't think you'll give it to me anyway, but I want to point out that surely a normal household is not going to have that particular socioeconomic scenario attached. Conversely, I would also argue that, well, what makes your writing unique is the fact that it is a distinct voice behind this. So why this concern with the modifier normal in this answer, and also in pertaining to your writing?
Well, that number has been floating out there for about a year now, and I knew when it got published that people were going to attach meaning to it and take it and run with it. And the reason I never even wanted to talk about income at all is I don't want people to read me through the filter of some random number, because they'll either judge me as either that she's not making enough for what she's doing, or she's making too much for what she's doing and she's not good enough for that, whereas not taking me for just the story that I'm telling.
Yeah.
And for me to emphasize the word normal, I mean, has my income increased since I went professional? Absolutely. My income has increased. But I have not changed my life in any discernible way. I still shop at Target. I still cut coupons. I still drive two cars that are paid for and, you know, save money and buy things on sale. It just hasn't affected me as a human being.
Yeah.
And it hasn't changed my writing either. So I guess the focus on the money just doesn't make sense to me at all. It doesn't.
Nevertheless, though, there is a difference when you're making a decision and you do have a financial cushion versus struggling to essentially get by from a month-to-month standpoint. So that's why I've lived through that.
I mean, yeah. I've lived through that many, you know, for many, many years I lived through that. And so I almost feel like now not being in that situation, I can speak to various ways of living. Yeah. And it's still, I'm still informed by who I was during that time as well.
Yeah. I mean, is this a way of essentially keeping yourself honest or normal? Why should normalcy even matter if you do have a particular voice?
Okay, and this is going to be the last question. Sorry. We've got like
yeah.
200 people
out
there.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. let's just end it. Let's just end it there. Sorry.
Okay.
Bye.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, just that I don't know. I feel because my readers want to know that what I'm going through is very similar to what they're going through. And that is the essential core of the story. And I am just a normal human being. A figure of money doesn't change that. It just doesn't change it.
Well, Heather, I know you have to speak before 200 people, but thanks so much for taking the time out. It was a pleasure chatting.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
My baby is tonight. I wonder where my baby is tonight. She's